Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
As we told you before, we are running a short series showcasing three academic papers that were nominated for the European Data Protection Law Review Award that was handed out at the CPDP conference last January. Our guest today wrote the third and final nominated paper that has just been published in the recent EDPL issue. Catherine Quezada Tavares wrote her paper on the impact of the right of access in the balance between security and fundamental rights, not just focusing on the GDPR, but also on the EU's Law Enforcement Directive and the so-called PNR Directive on the collection and use of traveler data for law enforcement and counterterrorism purposes. I think you might guess by now that this is a topic very close to my heart, where the last time Kay was very excited to be speaking about genetic data. So Catherine Quezada is a legal researcher at the Leuven Catholic University, their Center for IT and IP Law, and she's also an LLM graduate of the same Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium, but also holds a law degree from the Universidad Autónoma de Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic, one of her mother countries. In the past, she was also part of the Ibero-American Youth Leadership Program, so it's quite the international experience that Kay and I would love to hear more about in today's conversation. My name is Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. So Catherine, welcome. We are delighted to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm really, really delighted to be here, and thank you for this experience and this opportunity to be with you on your kitchen table.
Exactly. Thank you. So, unexpected question. Name one item you can't throw away.
Well, I would say that I have like a ring, a graduation ring I got at the university, Universidad Autónoma de Santo Domingo, as Paul mentioned at the beginning, that I received from the hands of the rector. And it was because I was like the class valedictorian. It was, that the special prize that they give to this graduate. And for me, it has such a value, that ring, not because of the how much it costs or whatever, but what it means to me, what it represents, that moment of my life or academic life in general. It's, I mean, something that I cannot get rid of in any case, whatever happens, let's say.
Yeah, I understand that completely. Paul, what about you?
There is a bronze statue that's in my house that was given to me by my parents a few years ago. And the statue is by Käthe Kollwitz, which is a German sculptress who lived around the First World War. And she sculpted a lot. She also drew a lot, especially in charcoal, about life in Germany around that time. Of course, the First World War, German was on the wrong side of history. And the sculptures that she has made represent also part of her sorrow. Her two sons were forced to fight during the war, which she much regretted because she was a pacifist. And two of her sculptures are also on the graves of her sons in Flanders Fields. And for my father, who bought the sculpture originally, she also symbolizes the Nie wieder Krieg, never war again movement, but also the need to continue to cooperate with each other in Europe and to help to understand each other. So even though it is just a bronze sculpture between parentheses, there is so much more meaning to it because of why my father bought it and why my parents gave it to me to really and stress that European upbringing that I've had.
Wow. So Catherine, I don't know if you're feeling it, but Paul's inability to throw away something that has such powerful meaning makes me feel a little weird about mine's Betty Boops.
This you need to explain.
I collect Betty Boop. I've always been in love with Betty Boop. I think she's fantastic. And I have lots of collections. I mean, there's lots. I don't know if Betty Boop is big in Europe or other countries or anything, but she has an interesting history to how she was created. She was originally a dog, and they turned her dog ears into the big earrings that she wears. And Popeye came from Betty Boop. He was a sailor that showed up to party with her, and audiences loved Popeye so much in the Betty Boop films that Popeye became his own featured character in film and everything. And so olive oil stole Popeye from Betty Boop. Wrap your head around that one. Okay, Paul, let's dive into the really important topic of the day, because I know this is a topic that you're fascinated and one of your favorite subjects.
It is, but before we really dive into the paper, let me start with the question to Catherine. How did you end up into privacy? Because you are attached to the Center for IT and IP Law, which is not immediately all about privacy and data protection. So why did you come to this topic for your thesis and then subsequently the paper?
Well, my history in privacy started quite early in my career, I should say, like already when I finished my law degree back in the Dominican Republic. I started getting into the topic of cybercrime, let's say. Of course, cybercrime is not the same.
Oh, I like that.
So cybercrime is not the same as privacy. I know, and I know you might.
Right. But no, it's so connected. Exactly. I love the nuances there. Yeah.
And then after that, I went on to doing my first master's, which was in criminology and forensic science. And there I continued into cybercriminology, which is combining a little bit cybercrime again. So getting into those topics of technology law and that have some relation to privacy, let's say. And then there came a lot of, I was always in touch with the technology news and hearing about all these cases, important decisions, like, for example, the Google Spain case was all over the news. And I heard all the implications that had. And also, for example, when the GDPR also came into effect, everybody around the world was talking about it. And I got more and more interested into this topic. And then I started looking for my next academic experience. In this case, this LLM program offered at Leuven in the end was the one that I decided to do. Of course, they cover many aspects there. And part of the aspects they cover is privacy, precisely. Privacy and data protection. There's even one of the main courses offered there that is about privacy and data protection. And you may say that, well, maybe the name Center for IT and IP Law doesn't necessarily tell you that much of what it's done there is privacy and data protection. But I can tell you that the work that we do there, for example, I participate in many European projects, EU-funded research. Mm-hmm. And there, most of the research that we do is precisely on privacy and data protection. Although in principle it's not apparent from the name of the center, let's say, that is really something that we are doing a lot. So, of course, in my whole trajectory, I was always interested into these topics, and then suddenly I came across this program offered in the university, and also saw the kind of work that they do in the Center for IT and IP Law, and that's when I decided, I first landed a job at the center. And then, of course, the idea was to combine it with the program. And that's how I'm here today. I did the master's, I wrote my master thesis, and that is what we are discussing, basically.
Interesting. And then the average student would say, well, if I'm dealing with privacy, I'll write about GDPR. And you chose to write about the law enforcement directive that hardly anybody has written about so far. Probably most of our listeners outside of Europe have no idea that there is such a thing as the LED, the Law Enforcement Directive, which was adopted on the same day as GDPR and is basically the same as GDPR, but then for law enforcement. And since law enforcement is within the domain of the member states, it cannot be a regulation like the GDPR, but needs to be a different kind of law. Just right. As a bit of technical background.
And we've only brought it up a couple of times on our podcast. I mean, it came up once, I think when we were talking to Ralph, Ralph O'Brien on one of those, because he's very involved in law enforcement. But we brought it up most recently in talking about the UK adequacy opinions that have been issued, that they issued two, one for law enforcement and one for GDPR. So I love diving into this more, probably not as much as Paul does, but I do love the opportunity to dive into this more. I think it's something a lot of privacy professionals are overlooking, as Paul said.
And that's precisely the reason why I was like, when I started the master's, I didn't know exactly which topic I would write about, but I knew it had to do with the law enforcement directly, because it's like, I just heard about that instrument when I started working at CITIB because of the law enforcement projects that I'm working on. I'm working in security projects. And there I was like, well, we have this other instrument that it's similar to the GDPR, but has some differences here and there because of the sector where it is applied. But nobody talks about it. I mean, I barely hear about it in the news. I don't see that many publications also, because when you look about data protection, you see a lot of scientific research going on regarding GDPR. And I was like, why? This is a very important instrument that has also significant rights for people, and that maybe it's not being enforced properly. It's not being used properly. It's not being also studied enough, let's say. So I knew from the beginning, yes, I mean, this is going to be about the law enforcement directive or something about the law, the data protection in the law enforcement sector. But because I was already kind of familiar with those issues because of my work. And yeah, I mean, I'm very happy that I chose that topic, because I think there needs to be more conversation about it, about this law enforcement, data protection in law enforcement context.
I'm very curious, because you are writing about especially the access rights in the law enforcement directive as a way for citizen empowerment. Obvious question is, of course, does it work?
Yeah, that's a good question. And for us to know that, I mean, one thing is, you know, you have the law, you have these directives that they prescribe certain issues, like, for example, they provide data subjects with the right to access their data, their personal data. They can ask competent authorities to get access to their data, similar to the GDPR. But the difference is that here you need to look at not only what the directives say, but how they have been implemented into national law. So do they work in practice or not? For you to know that, you need to look at the national transposition. You need to look at also what are the national practices about these issues. It's very, very difficult to know unless you have really gone into that part. And I must say that in my master, in the context of my master thesis, I actually was involved in a broader, let's say, research endeavor, which also involved an empirical part. And that research endeavor, we had the opportunity to, let's say, see how these directives operate in practice. And the little experience that I have, I can tell you, well, it doesn't seem to work that well in principle. But of course, I mean, that was a very, let's say, my own experience. And I think there needs to be more research on this to really find out how these things operate in practice.
Because I guess for a master's thesis, you did not look at the implementations in all 27 or at the time 28 member states and did a full comparison for all of those. That would sound more like a PhD proposal.
Yeah, exactly. We did look in this study, because this was a study where various students participated. I was not the only one. There were some doctoral researchers from CITIB and also some students of the master's. And we did look at some national transpositions of specifically the access rights, let's say, into these two directives, but only of certain, I mean, in 12 countries, let's say, 12 EU countries. But for example, in my thesis, since the main focus was not necessarily the empirical part, because each student has had to choose, let's say, one angle from which to approach the issue. And in my case, it was the balance between security and fundamental rights. Then, of course, I did not really dig too much into it. I mean, I am aware of what happens, and I participated into the study. I contributed to it, And also to another publication that came from it afterwards, which focused specifically in the empirical part. But yeah, of course, we couldn't look at all the national implementations because you would need a lot more time than what you have when in the context of a master thesis, let's say.
Absolutely. So are people actually using that right of access? I mean, I know it exists on paper, and I know that in the past, under the old legislation, also at the Dutch DPA, where I worked at the time, every once in a while would receive an indirect access request for the DPA to go and verify a police file. But are individuals actually aware that they can access law enforcement files on them, or at least try to access that?
In principle, it seems like not so many people are aware of these rights. And that's one of the big issues with, let's say, the data subject rights, not only under the law enforcement directive and the PNR directive, but all even in the GDPR, not so many people still are exercising those rights. So imagine if under the more general data protection framework, there's already a problem of awareness of really enforcement of those rights, what is it going to be in the law enforcement sector? Where people don't even know that much about these instruments, right? So yes, I would say that there needs to be like more awareness for people to know, like, hey, this, you have this right here. You have the opportunity to know what law enforcement agencies, the competent authorities in your countries, what do they have about you? And that can be so important for a data subject, so important for a citizen also, that it really needs, the enforcement needs to improve definitely of these rights.
And how would we solve that? How do we raise more awareness for these rights? Should the police just advertise every time that they are having searches on the street? You can file an access request or hand out leaflets if they monitor a demonstration in the streets, or tell people when they read them their rights when they are being arrested. How can we make the public more aware of the fact that these rights not only apply in companies, but also against law enforcement?
Well, one of the issues, one of the initiatives can come from the law enforcement, the competent authorities themselves, let's say. And that's already kind of mandated by law, because one of the provisions of the law enforcement directive is that they have to kind of say, publicize in any ways, like all the information or the information about the rights that people have. So they need to inform in some way. Normally they do it through their websites. That's like the typical way of doing it, showing like, yeah, these are the rights that you have. You don't necessarily need to mention that that's under data protection law, but you can say it, and you need to inform people about those rights. But we don't only need to leave it for competent authorities to do it. There are other initiatives that we can take. For example, data protection authorities can also provide some kind of in their awareness campaigns, in when they are, because they have these activities where they try to make people aware of their data subject rights or the data protection law more broadly. They can also include a little bit more information about this context as well. And
have you noticed that any law enforcement agencies or data protection agencies are doing this effectively?
Well, to be honest, to my knowledge, I cannot really say about, well, yes, I can mention, for example, in the context of this study of the master thesis, we had to look at some of these websites of the competent authorities that we were, let's say, studying. And yes, some of them do provide some information, even a very detailed information on how people can exercise their rights. Well, very detailed information. They provide information on how you can exercise your okay. rights. They also even provide some forms that people can use for the access rights. For example, in Malta, which is, you might think, oh, well, it's a small country, maybe not necessarily the data protection laws in the law enforcement context don't necessarily need to be that advanced. I don't know. But yeah, they do have some information, like a document that people can access in their website, and with all the details on how to exercise their rights, for example. And from data protection authorities, I cannot really think right now about a case where they do, let's say, publicize that much, that these rights also exist in this context. But maybe there are.
But that's really interesting to think where people would go to find out. I mean, if privacy people aren't paying much attention to this, it's interesting to see where would the average person find out information on it. So I was looking up Malta just to see what it's like. And you're right. If it's a small country, that might be why they have good information. It's because they're more connected with the population of their entire country. I'm just throwing out a wild idea here. Paul, don't roll your eyes at me. But that could be one reason why. But, you know, I mean, isn't that like privacy notices anywhere? People just don't read them. Shouldn't it be like printed on the ticket if you're going to get a ticket?
Well, ideally, yes. I mean, that would be the best way to do it, or at least provide a link to a privacy notice on the ticket. But every time that you collect personal data, you should provide notice. So that would be the same for the police.
Yeah, which makes sense.
The thing is also that the police also collects data in a way that we don't always know how they do it. And that makes sense in some situations. Like they have to investigate crime, they have to prevent crime. If they somehow provide all the information to all the people all the time about what they're doing, let's say they're investigating, I don't know, a high-risk sex offender. And they let this person know, hey, we are collecting your data. We are monitoring you. I don't think.
Yeah, let's put a notice on your door to let you know that we're following you 24/7.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, of course, in certain situations, it makes sense that they do collect data and you don't necessarily know it from the beginning. But of course, there are some limits to that. And that's where the balance part comes into play, because it's like, of course, they have this duty to investigate crime, to detect crime, to do these law enforcement activities, but there are some limits to that. And sometimes we have heard stories, we have seen also evidence that sometimes those limits are, let's say, surpassed. And the thing with, of course, there's the secrecy sometimes is justified, let's say, but at some point it needs to stop. And I as a citizen, I would like to know sometimes, like, Have you done your processing activities correctly, lawfully? Have you stick to the rules while doing that? And that is exactly when you can use this data subject rights, in this case, the right of access, which was the focus of my paper, for you to really know, okay, do they have any data about me? And if so, have they really followed the rules? Have they really complied with all these provisions and safeguards under data protection law? I would like to know. I know that also not many citizens or not all the citizens might be interested, but I mean, that's something that it's there, and I think it should be.
What? No, I get what you're saying. Y'all have the requirements to do, like, judge orders for warrants and searches and things like that, right?
Yes.
Okay. And in that case, we have what's called FOIA, Freedom of Information Act. And it sounds like this might be a lot of the same thing, that certain information that law enforcement authorities may have is protected, but then after a certain number of years pass, then they can generally release it. Of course, our FOIA has a lot of exemptions for law enforcement as well. But who thinks to do that other than typically reporters?
It is slightly different because our Freedom of Information Acts typically only apply with regard to government authorities, and the police are not regarded to administrative government, but as operational. But there are also, under data protection laws, you have the so-called restriction provisions. So it is allowed to have certain restrictions in your legislation to, for example, limit individual rights, like the right of access if you are under investigation. But there is one big precondition, and that is that the essence of the fundamental right needs to be respected. And that is why, at least in the past, oftentimes you could go to your data protection authority or to a DPO and ask them to inspect the file on your behalf. They were not able to give you the information from the file, not even confirm if there is a file, only if there were a file, then everything was in order, or maybe not, but that they have verified that everything is being processed according to the
law. Yes, and that's very good that you say that, Paul, because that possibility for the indirect access also exists under the law enforcement directive and also under the PNR directive. So the thing is that if, I mean, of course, there might be legitimate reasons for competent authorities to not provide you with the data, as you were rightly saying. But if they do that, first of all, they need to have a justification for that. It's not just simply like, oh, well, we think there might be probably reasons. They need to justify the reasons to do that. And whenever they do that, you, as a data subject, you have the possibility to go to the National Supervisory Authority or Data Protection Authority. In some cases, it's really the Data Protection Authority to ask, okay, right, can you go and check that, I mean, the lawfulness of that denial, the reasons for that denial. And of course, in the end, the data subject doesn't receive any information from the Data Protection Authority once those checks have been done. But something that I came across during my research is that in principle, this possibility of indirect access might look like, oh, well, it's just an extra step to, let's say, kind of, I don't know, make it more complicated, but it doesn't really work because it's simply like the, let's say, bothering data protection authorities and saying, go and check. But that doesn't necessarily work in practice or it doesn't have any effect. Actually, it does have important effects for the data subjects because for a person, for example, I have seen some examples of people, let's say in France, mm-hmm. I saw some of these reports, annual reports by the Data Protection Authority in France, where they had specific sections about indirect access. And you can see that some people, that possibility of indirect access meant the opportunity to, let's say, have access to a job because it appeared that some of the data was unlawfully processed for much longer than it was supposed to. And then, of course, the person was denied access because of whatever reasons. And then when the Data Protection Authority came and checked the lawfulness of that processing, then that processing had to stop. And that meant the possibility to, exclude that information that was not supposed to be in the police record, was not supposed to be there. It was excluded. And then the person was able to, let's say, access to some labor opportunities. And that's just a minor example. There are other examples that you can think of, like a person that suddenly was included, let's say, was involved in a case file, not as a suspect or anything. It was just her partner was being investigated. And of course, she was questioned during the investigation, but that stayed also in her criminal record. I mean, of course, if you try to access that information, they don't want to give it to you, the competent authorities, then the Data Protection Authority comes on your behalf and check the lawfulness and realizes that there are problems with the lawfulness of that processing. Also, really that opportunity for you to amend those data protection violations that have been committed. And I think, yeah, that's really important. Also why I also think, well, it's important to have these rights under the GDPR and other instruments, but in a law enforcement context, you see the real consequences that it can really have for people's lives to have these opportunities to access to their data, not only directly, if it cannot be done directly because of the security interests, let's say, that may be at stake, at least indirectly, they can resolve the situations that were not resolved in another way.
So can we talk a little bit about the PNR directive and the work you did there? PNR, passenger name records data, so that's all the booking information from a plane ticket or a hotel booking. It's a six-digit or letter code, typically, that provides all that information, but it contains your name, it contains your passport number, it links to your credit card information, any special travel advisory requirements, for example, if you are disabled and need assistance. So it is a lot of information that governments first wanted to start collecting following the Madrid and London attacks for counterterrorism purposes, and then also to fight serious crime, especially human trafficking. But it is pretty controversial because the European courts, like with telecommunications data, have said many times that you cannot just collect all these data of all the people all of the time because that would be too big of an infringement on the fundamental rights to privacy and data protection. We can see a trend there. The courts are pretty consistent. But still, the European Union has their PNR, which should have been implemented by many member states or all of the member states for many years already. It's still a bit vague what the status is. What have you found out about the PNR directive?
Well, actually, I know that the PNR directive is very hardly criticized by many people because it's really like a mass surveillance system that is implemented across the EU in the end. And it's being challenged in court, of course, and some people don't agree with that system. But in my study, what I came to the conclusion is that, well, it's true, there's this mass surveillance. You might agree with it or not, but let's say it's there. But they implemented some safeguards. And in this case, it was some fundamental rights safeguards. In particular, there are data protection provisions, let's say. So basically, the PNR directive implements or, let's say, also incorporates the data protection provisions or the protections safeguarded on the law enforcement directive. And also there are other, let's say, safeguards in relation to non-discrimination, for example, to make sure that, okay, you provide these capabilities to competent authorities in the fight against terrorism and the public security concern. But at the same time, you couple that with certain protections such that maybe to make sure that there is, again, the balance of giving certain possibilities to process data, in this case, PNR data, but with safeguards in place. And part of the safeguards or part of the ways of the balancing part is really, okay, the data subject rights. In this case, also the right of access to your personal data under the PNR directive as well, which is along the same lines of the law enforcement directive, basically.
Interesting. I can go on for hours about these kind of issues, but now that we have you here, might we maybe jump a little bit to the Dominican Republic? If we can't travel in person, maybe we can travel at least virtually.
Yes, there is actually privacy. Well, privacy is actually a right also from the constitution of the country. But yes, there's a data protection law. It is a bit different from what we have here in Europe. But yeah, it's let's say an evolving area of law there. They are making progress in that sense, let's say.
But your big ambition, of course, is to become the privacy commissioner of the Dominican Republic. But what is next in store for you? You've now published a paper. You've been nominated for an EDPL Scholar Award. Is privacy your future, or are you still thinking about what else to do, what routes to take?
Well, I would say, to me, at this moment, maybe tomorrow I change my mind, but at this moment, it seems clear to me that I came to privacy to stay, basically, because I really like this work, working in this field. And the next step basically seems to be the possibility to do a PhD in this field. Obviously, not only just privacy, but, you know, I will focus on the law enforcement context, which is what I have been doing the last 2 years, basically. And yes, I think that's the road that I might take from now on.
I like that, especially when you're looking at the cross-section of law enforcement and privacy, and there simply aren't a whole bunch of people who specialize in that area. Final question. So, Catherine, when we invited you to come on here, was there anything that you had in mind that you wanted to make sure that you could share with our listeners that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, I was just thinking, like, I have to make sure to get specific message across. And that is, we have data subject rights. There are data subject rights beyond the GDPR, or not even data subject rights. I would say data protection and privacy and data protection beyond the GDPR. And people, you have to make sure to use, to enforce these rights. There might be significant consequences for people when let's say data processing is in a law enforcement context are not lawful or are not done in a proper way. So it's very important for us to be aware of these rights, to be aware of all these rules and to enforce them more and more, and to also, let's say, improve the conversation around these topics. because it's very good to have a very dynamic conversation in the more general data protection framework, but let's also give some attention to the law enforcement.
Well, Kay, I think we have some homework to do here.
Right.
And that we, in any case, need to invite maybe some people on your end from FBI and CIA and get some more insights on how they deal with privacy and data protection. And in any case, on our end, reach out to Europol and my former contacts there.
I think so.
And see if we can get some people from the Europol privacy team on the podcast later this year. So for that, stay tuned. Catherine, thank you very much for being with us today. Congratulations again on your nomination for the EDPL Young Scholar Award. It's a great paper. All three papers from all three nominees are out now in the latest edition of the European Data Protection Law Review, and I'm sure they will be published somewhere else at some point as well for those who may not have access to the EDPL. So go read them. Follow these three amazing scholars, because all of them, whether it is Isabel, whether it is Tanner, or now Catherine, you've heard three very passionate young people who will make big steps in privacy. Kay and I will make sure to follow them in the years to come.
Absolutely, because we've had, if you add in the person right before them, Wayne Unger, we've had some very talented young professionals. These little
Absolutely.
Whippersnappers are intimidating.
Well, yes, but I guess some people will say the same about us still. So we don't have to be too scared yet. But absolutely, there is a great new generation of privacy professionals coming into the field. So
yes.
Thank you to all our listeners for listening to another episode of Serious Privacy. If you have written a privacy paper and would like to discuss it, feel free to submit it to and maybe invite you in the future for one of these conversations at our kitchen table. So reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. For now, thank you for listening. Until next week, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.